Greetings to our global neighbors and all the ships at sea. From coast to coast, border to border, this is Message Traffic from Washington, D.C., presented by the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs.
Hey, this is Justin Russell, the Principal Director of the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs and the moderator of our new podcast, Message Traffic. I wanted to jump in here before we started the interview and first give our express and most humbled appreciation to Ben Rosewell and the team up there at the Canadian International Council. The folks up at the council have been very gracious in allowing us to interview Ben in our first episode, kind of like when the president first gets inaugurated. His first trip overseas is usually to Canada or Mexico. In this case, we chose to go north. So to Ben Rosewell and the entire team up at the Canadian International Council, thank you so much for being our inaugural interview. And also just wanted to point out, cut us a little bit of slack on the post-production quality. We're still working on that, but the content and the sentiment is still there. It's still a great interview. It's worth the listen. Thanks for subscribing. Thanks for joining us and enjoy this great interview.
And, you know, the great thing about this podcast format is we get to start off with somebody, and we are so, so fortunate to have Ben Rosewell, who is the president and chief researcher. Is it, Ben, is that your title?
Director of Research.
Director of Research. For the Canadian International Center. He is the former ambassador to Venezuela. He is a 25-year veteran of the diplomatic corps there in Canada. He has served in Egypt, Iraq, Afghanistan, and at the mission to the UN. Ben, thanks for joining us for this first podcast of Message Traffic.
Hey, it's a real honor to be your inaugural guest. I'm excited for the conversation and excited about the mission that you guys have to bring foreign policy to the citizens of the United States, because that's pretty much what we do for the citizens of Canada.
Well, you know what? That's the great thing about it is, Ben, is I was looking at your website and have become familiar with your organization. But for those here in our subscription world and our listeners, talk about the center for a second. It sounds like there's a lot of commonality between our mission here in the U.S. and your mission there north of the border.
Yeah, it sounds that way. We were created in the 1920s, which, like the United States, was actually a time of real isolationism in Canada, when Canadians really wanted to have nothing to do with the world, particularly with Europe, with its tendencies to engage in these self-destructive wars. And yet, we were starting to become very globally connected, you know, the multicultural population and very trade dependent. And so a number of former diplomats and former prime ministers and former business people came together to create an organization to educate the Canadian public about international affairs, not to advocate for any particular policy or, you know, favor this country or that country, just to increase the literacy of our citizens about what was happening in the world, so that governments could take decisions knowing that they, you know, that there was public support for what we were doing. Because to do foreign policy well, you have to make choices. You've got to make trade-offs. There's going to be some citizens that benefit and some that don't. And so if you don't have your citizenry on board, you're not actually going to be very effective in international relations. And ultimately, that means you're not going to be very able to deliver for those citizens.
Right.
That's ultimately why we do foreign policy, right? Is to advance the interests of our citizens.
Now, I've got to ask the typical Washington question. You know, we here in Washington, you either lean red, Republican, conservative, or blue, progressive, Democrat. We have taken a very bipartisan, almost apolitical aspect to what we do here. Similar mentality with your center, as far as not leaning so much pro-Tory or pro-labor. You're pretty much apolitical, working with all parties.
Yeah, we're nonpartisan. We have a less polarized electorate than the United States. It helps that we have five parties instead of two. Right, the liberals are in power right now. The conservatives are the other other party that's formed government. But we have a social democratic party called the NDP. We've got a Quebec separatist party. We've got a Green Party that's starting to get bigger and bigger. And so it's a bit more of a heterogeneous sort of ideological environment in Canada, and that makes a center like ours a lot easier for us to be completely nonpartisan and not affiliated with any one particular perspective.
Oh, that's fantastic. Hey, you know, obviously in the past, it's been an interesting 4 years for the relationship between Ottawa and Washington. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, how has the past 4 years of a Trump administration been for our closest trading partner, our closest ally, our closest friend in the world, our next door neighbors, Canada? How has this been? Has it been as interesting as we think it has been?
I would call it a disaster averted. A disaster, a potential disaster, because after 75 years of us aligning ourselves very, very closely with the United States, being a major contributor to American national security, a largest trading partner, we buy more of your goods than any other country. We're by far your most significant economic partner and a major factor of American prosperity. Here comes a president who all of a sudden calls us a threat to the United States and almost considered us as an enemy country.
Right.
And that really threw us for a loop. Like, we're not used to being considered anyone's enemy, but to be considered an enemy to the country that we're this connected to and that we're this, you know, supportive of and loyal towards, we felt like we were just cut at the knees. Now, I think it was a disaster averted because this particular government under Justin Trudeau, recognizing how important the relationship was, decided not to get too emotional about it. To have this kind of this too shall pass approach to things. I think it was actually quite a deft management of President Trump. Trump didn't like Trudeau. He scuttled a major summit of the G7 that Canada hosted with some personal insults against our prime minister. But unlike other people insulted by Trump, he decided not to rise to the challenge, just to kind of keep his feelings to himself. Avoided lots of opportunities from Canadian journalists, like trying to get him to denounce, you know, his support for white nationalists or opposition to, the human rights of refugees or what have you, and not rise to the bait. And the focus was to make sure we get our trading relationship protected through a renegotiation of NAFTA, and we succeeded with that. NAFTA is still in force. It's got a different name, but it's more or less the same agreement. And so the fundamental basis of the relationship remains undamaged by 4 years of intentional attempt to damage it by the President of the United States.
We talk about, you know, the relationship between Prime Minister Trudeau and President Trump. Lesser was, and kind of the back channels that we kind of expect, How do you view the relationship between our Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and your minister, François-Philippe Champagne, as foreign minister? I take it he's still foreign minister up in Ottawa. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, it was a working relationship. You know, Canada is so dependent on the United States for our trade and for our security.
Right.
That we put our best and our brightest on managing relationships with the United States. And so you tend to have real consummate professionals and professionalism in their engagement with American counterparts. It's not just within the executive as well. It's also the legislative. We've got, very, very close relationships with senators and members of Congress on both sides of the aisle, and very, very deep relationships at the level of individual states and provinces, almost every state in the union depends on Canada for trade. I mean, Canada is the principal export market for something like 40 of the 50 states of the US. And so that gives us an easy entree. Like when we talk to the governor of Michigan, like we know that she's going to take Canada seriously because Michigan jobs depend on good relations with Canada. And so what we do in our approach to the United States is to, it's like a sort of all front press that we engage the United States through all of the levels of government and all the branches of government to make sure that this relationship is as solid as possible. And that's how we can survive the destruction of someone like Donald Trump.
So let me go back to this for a second, though, is how important was the relationship between the foreign minister and the secretary of state? I mean, was there a closeness there that we just don't see as
natural affinity,
American?
I should point out, I mean, the Liberal Party of Canada, the one that's in government,
right,
is to the left of the Democratic Party, for sure. Like the Democrats, which is like quite far on the right side of the spectrum in Canada. So when you're dealing with a Liberal, and there's a Liberal from Quebec, which is the most left-wing province in Canada. So this is not like an ideological,
a mind meld of ideology between and Philippe Champagne.
No. So there's a really good professional working relationship. But from a Canadian perspective, I think to a large extent, it's kind of defensive, like just holding on to what we have so far and making sure that any of the damage coming out of the White House is quickly contained and that we can kind of move on to whatever the next issue would be.
Right. Let's talk about how relieved are the Canadians as far as anticipating a Biden administration moving forward over the next few years. Is there a sense of relief? Is there a sense of calm? Is there possibly a sense of horror with some of the Tories up there?
No. I think there's a genuine positive reaction across the political spectrum. Canadian conservatives were also, I think, quite offended at having our nation termed a national security threat to the country that we've sacrificed to for so much over the last 75 years, that there was real dislike of Trump among Canadian conservatives as well. There's a natural affinity with the sort of what I would call the more sort of traditional Republicans than our Canadian conservatives, but not with the
ideological Trumpness of the Republican Party as it stands today.
I'd say there's a reaction at several levels. The first is that Canada is extraordinarily dependent on there being a rules-based international order, there being some degree of predictability in the way that international affairs are conducted and the way that great powers advance their interests, whether they do it with allies or against allies. And so there's a sense of optimism that Biden is someone who wants to build international order as opposed to disrupt it. He's someone who wants to work with allies. He wants to strengthen institutions like NATO and the UN and the World Trade Organization. That's all great news for Canada, because to the extent that there's rules and predictability in an otherwise chaotic world, a medium-sized power like Canada does better. We don't do so well when it's the Wild West at the international level. So that's great. In terms of the bilateral relationship, I suppose there's some mixed feelings across the political spectrum, but generally confidence that Biden knows Canada really, really well. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris actually grew up in Montreal and went to high school in Montreal. So that's pretty awesome. I don't think we've ever had a vice president who's actually lived in our country before. And that kind of affinity.
It's a nice connection to have with the White House.
Yeah. Now there is fears of protectionism. Generally, Republican presidents have been more pro-trade and therefore less likely to impose tariffs on Canada. Trump again sort of broke the mold on that one. But conversely, an incoming Biden administration, particularly one that has changed its tune on trade, say from the Obama years and certainly relative to the Clinton years, we'd be worried about like Buy America provisions, where all of a sudden Canadian companies might be locked out of lucrative defense contracts, that sort of thing. But I would consider that pretty small beer compared to the the big issues for Canada really are we going to have a rules-based, or is it going to be the Wild West of the unbridled competition between a Washington and a Beijing, right, that are just out for their own interests and are quite happy to trample any smaller countries underfoot.
And Ben, I am shocked that one of the words that has not come out of your mouth when you mentioned those topics is you did not mention the words softwood timber.
Well, that's a constant. You know, we've been having softwood lumber disputes since before we were a country. Yeah. I think the first official like court case against Canadian exporters of softwood lumber was from the 1850s and we're still at it in 2020. So I just consider that a constant. It doesn't matter who's in power. It doesn't even matter like what our countries are called. We're going to be arguing over softwood lumber until the end of time, I'm sure.
440 or fight somewhere in this discussion. Why not? I will tell you, looking at, as somebody who's dealt with Ottawa and the premier offices and several of the provincial governments, I've always enjoyed the relationship that has been and the closeness of the relationship that has been between Washington and Ottawa in Canada and the United States. As you pointed out in your comments earlier in this podcast, the strain that it caused between Trump and Trudeau and the U.S. and Canada, has that closeness been damaged, and is that damage is it unsalvageable? I guess
no,
is the
no, right I don't word. Think so. I think we're quite anxious to mend fences with the United States. You know, we're really quite pro-American as a country. Like we share the same ideals. We share the same views of what the good life is. We don't have peace. The pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is our mantra. Ours is good peace, order, and good government. But I mean, the American way of life resonates really strongly in Canada, and we really want to be your friends. Like that's in the best world, we are joined at the hip, and so that's our sort of fundamental impulse as a country. I mean, some Canadians, I'm sure, would like us to be a little more autonomous in the way we approach certain issues, and we certainly have a different approach to the role of citizen in society about solidarity between vulnerable populations and what have you. But generally, we're kind of hardwired to be pro-American, and we want things to work out. So we approach that relationship with a lot of trust. The bigger challenge for Canada is that we're likely to just not be ignored. I mean, every country in the world considers the United States its most important bilateral partner, and there's a lot of damage to be undone now. And so we'll be competing with all the other countries in the world that'll be coming to the Biden administration with this or that initiative. Now, sometimes in foreign policy, not being at the top of the American government's agenda is a good thing. The countries that tend to be at the top are the ones that are in trouble or that have some trouble coming their way.
Correct.
But what I'm worried about in this new relationship between Biden and Trudeau is just that Canada is going to be taken for granted because, you know, things are not, you know, it's just not as big a priority for Washington. And I'm worried that we might miss some opportunities.
Yeah. Oh, definitely could see that concern. We've only got a few more minutes left, and I think we're going to go over just by a little bit, if that's okay, Ben. But real quickly, I want to touch on a couple of regions and get your take on it as far as the current as is and then the moving forward under a Biden administration. Let's talk about the Middle East, particularly Afghanistan, and then the other sensitive areas, Yemen, Libya, Iraq. You spent time as a diplomat in the Middle East, Egypt, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Is there going to be a I'm trying to think of the right way to put it, because it almost seems like the Trump announcement of the active withdrawal from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from even places like Africa are just so sudden and create such a vapor lock in those regions. Does this pose a problem for Canadian foreign policy when dealing with those areas, or is it an issue where Ottawa was possibly prepared or has anticipated something this dramatic happening at the end of a Trump administration?
Well, I'd say there's a vacuum of power in the Middle East because of the withdrawal of the United States, predating Trump. Obviously, Obama deciding not to get involved in the Syria conflict. That was sort of the beginning of a U.S. Reduction of presence in the Middle East, and in such an unstable area when there's a vacuum of power, when the presence of the United States is not felt, there'll be less scrupulous actors that will rise to fill that. I think we're seeing a really negative role being played by both Saudi Arabia and Iran as they're sort of turning the Middle East into this terrain for a proxy war between the two of them, supporting some pretty unsavory activities. And
just jump in real quick though, Ben, does that vacuum exacerbate the power of the Saudis, the Emiratis versus the Turks, and then even these far external players in the region, China and Russia?
Yes, they do. It certainly creates a lot of opportunities for Russia. I'm not sure to what extent the Chinese want to get involved, but the sheer destructiveness of the Syrian conflict could not be explained unless you attribute it to Russian involvement. And Russia was only involved to that extent because the United States kind of allowed Russia to be Russia involved. That would not have happened if the civil war in Syria broke out in the 1990s or even the 2000s. There would not have been this very, very prominent role of Russia, because they would have been concerned about how that would play in Washington as the dominant sort of global power interested in the Middle East. But the U.S. is more or less gone for the Middle East, and therefore Russia can make a common cause with a really terrible regime in Damascus. And, you know, here we have like 500,000 dead Syrians later as a result. There's a real cost to pay when there's a vacuum of power in an unstable region like the Middle East. And that's really where Canada's concern comes in. We don't have as much direct interest in the Middle East as the United States, but when there's instability and destruction on the scale that we've seen in places like Syria, that's where it starts causing problem for the whole war and in the whole world, in refugee flows and in destabilization of neighboring countries. And so we look to the withdrawal from the United States with some regret. It's perhaps something that might reverse under the Biden administration, but in general, that's been a trend for the worse in Canada's perspective.
You brought up something real quick, and I do want to ask your opinion on it. Canada has been tremendously gracious, welcoming as far as dealing with certain humanitarian crisis and welcoming the refugee populations into your country for refuge. We see the situation in Yemen, and yet we see this withdrawal and almost kind of hands-off approach with the Saudis, the Emiratis, and then we also see the Turks and the Iranians getting involved in that situation. Does the aggressiveness of those four key players give pause to Canada as far as international affairs happen, and then the domestic side of, can you handle that type of humanitarian crisis in Canada to take that kind of refugee level that might be considered historical for your country?
Well, we probably don't take as many refugees as might seem the case. We did operate in a sort of countercurrent to the closed borders to Syrian refugees in the 2015 period, but we still only let in 60,000. I mean, that's a pretty tiny amount of refugees given global refugee flows. So there's really not that many. I think at minimum, what I could say is that,
considering U.S. track record over the past 4 years, it's still
ratcheted right down to zero, which is really completely in contrast with historical precedent. But I think one thing I could say is that we've demonstrated, I think, pretty conclusively that when we allow refugees in, it has zero negative impact on the domestic security of Canada. There is no major problem of any kind with Islamic terrorism here. If anything, I think we're probably safer because we have an approach to Arab refugees we treat them like human beings. And I think ultimately that makes Canada a less attractive target to extremist Islamist extremists. So we're probably a safer country for having 60,000 Syrians into this into Canada. So our concern, I think, is when there's a massive humanitarian crisis abroad, it's going to create problems for international security. I think back to Afghanistan, where I served for quite a long time. I mean, the reason that there's been this forever war in Afghanistan, involving both of our countries for so much of the last 20 years, has its roots in a humanitarian crisis in the 1990s, when the country completely fell apart after the Soviets withdrew. None of the rest of us really cared much about Afghanistan. It's so far away. But as that country descended into chaos, the only force that was able to bring some order back was the Taliban in the 1990s. And that's why they're popular within Afghan society, to the extent that they're popular, even though they murder so many Afghans. So those humanitarian crises, like Afghanistan in the 1990s, have a way of creating tomorrow's wars. And that's where I think we'd be worried at the scale of the bloodshed in Yemen right now. Like, there's some sense that we'll be having podcasts in the 2040s, and we'll be talking about, wow, I wish we had done something in 20 to end the killing in Yemen.
So true. Last point I want to talk to you about, Venezuela. Venezuela has ironically come back into the fold here in the United States with the whole election. We won't even justify that talk, but there's still an issue in Venezuela as far as the power struggle between President Maduro and the opposition leader and the recognized president by the United States, Guaido. Is there a solution near term that we can see in the situation in Venezuela, or is it too far gone that we're just going to have to wipe the slate clean and hope for the best out of Caracas?
Well, at this point, we're looking at a consolidation of a dictatorial regime. There was a sense of there being some kind of transition for some time. There's obviously a lot of hope in early 2019 when the National Assembly interpreted the constitution in a way that allowed them to elevate Guaido as president, and then this like massive international response in favor of democracy in Venezuela. That moment is past now, unfortunately. The power struggle, the way I would express it, is actually not necessarily between Maduro and Guaido. It's between Maduro and the citizens of his country. He's widely reviled. If there was ever a democratic election, and this one this week was not democratic, he'd be tossed out in like the less time than it takes for me to complete the sentence. And that lack of popular mandate for the president, for Maduro, is what really creates instability for Venezuela.
Well, let me jump in real quick and ask this quick question. Is Venezuela too far gone? Is it a lost cause?
Well, it can't be a lost cause for the Venezuelans themselves, because they're stuck there, dying by the tens of thousands and coping with a completely collapsed healthcare system. So they're not going in a way. I mean, what does it look like if it's a lost cause? It'll look like Haiti. I mean, Haiti's never gone away. It's been pretty terrible for decades and decades and decades.
Right.
And when it does reach rock bottom, that just means more refugees and more instability being spread to other countries. And so we don't actually have the luxury of saying, well, I'm sorry, Venezuela, it didn't work out for you. Like, let's just stop talking about you and move on. Like, there's a sore in the heart of the Americas, this country that's, very, very strategically placed and is generating human misery, and it's emanating out of Venezuela, and it will be for decades. So we don't really have the choice, the luxury of giving up on Venezuela. I do think on the short term, we probably need to focus on bringing an end to the humanitarian catastrophe, of making sure that food and medicine get delivered to Venezuelans. They've been impeded in that by the Maduro government more than anything. And so my prescription for Venezuela is that we should be invoking the responsibility to protect that the international community has to the people of Venezuela, not using military means at all, because that would really just kill far more Venezuelans and that we're meaning to help, but to mobilize the full resources of Canada, the United States, hemispheric partners, in making sure that food and medicine get to the people of Venezuela. And as that process goes along, eventually work on restoring the democratic rights of the people of Venezuela.
Right. One last question is when we talk about foreign policy, are you guys finding that there is a general disregard or lack of interest or almost apathy towards foreign policy as there might be here in the United States? Is that something that can change? Yeah. Here in the U.S., we just get the impression it's about, do I have a job? Do I have a roof over my head? Do I have the ability to provide for my family? What happens overseas really doesn't affect me. Is there a similar mentality that we see north of the border?
Yeah, I think very much so. And maybe even more in Canada, because we also don't have, you know, a national government that's a superpower and that has the ability to project its force overseas. So there's also a mistaken assumption I think a lot of Canadians have that we're powerless. Like, why bother worrying about the world? There's nothing we can do about it. And I think that's one of the reasons that we exist as an organization, is to try and convince Canadians that no, in fact, Canada can have an influence. We have had in the past, and there's enough bad stuff happening in the world and bad stuff that's going to come to us at some point, that we it's imperative that Canada do more on the international stage and that we care more. We have a relatively low military spending. Our development assistance is much lower than it used to be. And so there's a lot more that Canada could be doing. We used to say that we punched above our own weight as a middle power in the world, and I don't think many Canadians believe that anymore. And so we're contributing to that same kind of vacuum that I was complaining about the United States leaving a vacuum before.
Right.
It's also up to us as countries that have a real vested interest in a well-functioning international order to step up to the plate. And so I think that's a mission that we're dedicated to here in the CIC, is to make sure that as an incoming Biden administration is starting to step up to the plate
right. In
crises around the world, that they know that they can count on Canada as well.
Well, we've blown through the half hour and got another 12, 15 minutes. I could do this for another hour, but this is a fascinating discussion and a discussion we'd obviously want to keep moving forward. The importance of the relationship between Canada and the U.S. is more important now than it is ever. Ben Rosewell, the president of the Canadian International Council. Ben, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. This has been a great discussion.
I really enjoyed it, Justin. Let's do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I see it's 36 minutes here, so we weren't that much longer than half an hour. Oh, did we lose you?
For more information on the subject you just heard about, or any of our articles, reports, or events, log on to nycfpa.org. Also, please consider subscribing to Message Traffic on your favorite podcast service like Apple, Google, Spotify, or TuneIn Radio. You can also follow us on social media by searching for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For questions regarding the center, or just to let us know what you were thinking, you can email us at info@nycfpa.org. On behalf of the board and staff of the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs, thank you for listening.